Hello and welcome to Writers Aloud, the podcast about writing from the Royal Literary Fund. This episode is devoted to an interview with poet, fiction writer and librettist Elizabeth Cook. A former academic, Elizabeth is interested in the ways that the past is remodeled and retold, a subject she has explored in her poetry and critical writing, and in her novels, Achilles, which links Greek myth and Keats, and Lux, an enmeshment of the life of the biblical King David with that of the Tudor poet Thomas Wyatt. In the following conversation, she started out by telling me where writing began for her.
It started when I was a child, I think. I just wanted to make books. So I wrote stories when I was small and bound them and stitched them. Not as many as Emily Dickinson's fascicles or the Brontes, but I enjoyed actually the act of bookmaking as well as writing them.
Did anyone help you learn that, or did you teach yourself?
I taught myself. It was pretty clear to me what a book was because I had them around and read them and enjoyed reading them. So it just seemed a natural thing to try and make a few as well. One of my first books was called Wonders of the Fish World. Very informative, and another was called Bits of the Sun, because I thought I'd found a meteorite. I'm not sure if it was a meteorite, but I'd learnt a bit about what a meteorite was. And it began, as you all know, the sun is very hot, and when it gets too hot, it falls off. So it wasn't always works of fiction. I did write stories about children, usually 12-year-olds, because that seemed the really, really exciting age to be, sort of aspirational age, being carried off to fairyland, that sort of thing.
Now, you've written in a huge range of genres, poetry, prose, short and long form, fiction, essays, criticism, and libretti as well. Mm. What do you find the difference is between writing poetry and writing prose?
I think writing prose can be a much more deliberate act, and it can be much more willed than poetry. I don't find it possible to decide to write a poem if a poem hasn't sort of grabbed me in some way, if some element of a poem, maybe a rhythm, maybe an idea, maybe an image, they grab me and I have a feeling that there's a poem here and I need to give it space and let it unfold and watch it. And normally that's a really, really pleasurable experience. It may go on for hours, days, weeks. Almost nothing in writing makes me as happy as writing a poem and completing a poem and turning it, because I do feel a poem until it settles. You just turn and turn and turn and it is restless. And eventually, if you're lucky, it will find a sort of peaceful place when it's, yes, this is where it lives. Whereas prose, I find I can sit down and decide, well, I'm just going to get on with the novel today and write something. It may not be good, but I can usually write something as an act of will. When it flows, then there's a delight very close to the delight of writing a poem. But some of fiction writing is slog, actually, getting from one bit to another in a really tedious way. Of course, you can fly, you know, like Keats already with the, you know, with the Nightingale. You can just go instantly in a poem. It's much more hard won, I think, the transitions in fiction. Even if you do make a sudden transition, you have to work for it. I've only written one long fiction, Lux, and that took me all of 17 years. So the strange thing about working on something for so long is that you inevitably change in the process of writing something. And I was writing it in a sort of continuous loop. I kept going back to the beginning and then rewriting the beginning and changing the order. And ultimately, I think that the final form of it was arrived at in a relatively short space of time by someone who I could identify with as a sort of relatively stable person. Whereas a poem, even though a poem may be written over the course of months or occasionally years, usually represents a shorter piece of time. A poem seems to be much more like a short story. Years ago, I was a sort of first layer judge for a poetry and short story competition. And what I found was wrong with a lot of the stories I read was that people were attempting to write the great novel in 20 pages.
In the sense that they were trying to go for too big a subject, or how would you, can you explain that?
They were trying to cram in, yes, too large a subject, too long a narrative, too complex a narrative, and all their insights into life as well. And that really doesn't work. But I think a good story can be something very beautifully turned in a way, and there's a possibility that a story can be perfectly right, I think, which I don't think is possible in a long novel. And if it were perfection, I think it would be stifling and airless.
Yes. What I find really interesting, and I notice this in your writing and also in the way you talk about writing, is there's a real sense of tangibility, physicality. Mm. So you talk about having enjoyed the physicality of books, stitching them, making them as well. Mm. And you talk there about a story being perfectly turned,
yes,
a woodwork phrase. Mm. Is that how you think of your writing, as a very, very much a craft, a physical tangibility to it?
Yes, I think I do feel that. I write fairly slowly. Well, 17 years on a novel is pretty clear evidence of that. And I read very slowly. I don't know how that comes to be, but I hear every word that I read in my mind. So the sound and the physicality of words is incredibly important to me, as much so in prose as in poetry. So I'm very conscious of the weight and fall of words, the cadence of words.
So the physical feel of words seems to be quite present in your work.
Yes.
And physicality, textures and the feel and smells and tastes of things.
Yes.
Very, something comes off really vividly in your writing. Mm-hmm. And in looks, for example, one of the things that I found so impressive about it was the way it summoned very distant worlds, but that the physical experience of being in those worlds in a way that I don't think I've really seen much in writing about such distant experiences. Mm. The biblical story, David and Bathsheba. And there's a particular section that stands out in my mind where David, at a crisis point in the story, he retreats to a cave and prays and goes through a crisis of the soul, really, and all kinds of shifts go on. Mm. And yet, really, it's just a man sitting in a dark hole. And yet you manage to make this so, the reality of it, the physical experience and also the spiritual experience feels so real. And I mean, how do you go about getting that kind of layered, textured experience into your work?
Well, thank you for what you say, Anne. I do find myself at every stage of my writing thinking, when I'm writing fiction, what was it like? What would it have been like? And just asking that almost every inch of the way, which is possibly contributory factor to the slowness of it. But I think that's true of all fiction, isn't it? That one inches forward and you hope that a reader will sort of read it in half an hour, what you've been labouring over for days. It's a bit like making animated images, that the number of frames that have to be drawn for Donald Duck to
walk across the room.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah.
And I think writing fiction is a bit like that, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it has to seem ultimately very fluent if it's going to work. But it is, for me, always asking, you know, what did it feel like?
Mm.
What did it smell like? What's going on here?
I remember back when I was at university being taken by a lecturer to a museum where they had lots of replicas of Greek statues.
Mm.
And you saw those beautiful sort of alabaster, bleached figures, extraordinary works. And then being completely astonished when this lecturer told me that actually back in ancient Greek times they would have been painted and highly coloured.
Yes.
And I suddenly, it was a really powerful way of getting us to see how different our perception of what things might have been like or that idea of that world and the reality.
Yes.
And that it was a very different world, the culture, the way of thinking. How did you navigate that, dealing with, going back to, you know, biblical times and Achilles, you know, writing about Achilles, again, going returning to the ancient Greek world. How do you navigate that very different world, that very different way of seeing and being?
It's a difficult one, that, because I don't think we can really enter into a consciousness of the first millennium BC. Of course, again, going back to physicality, that is something we have in common, because the actual structure of a human body really hasn't changed very much at all. So that's somewhere to rely upon, I think, that continuity of the body, which interests me very much. and presumably some kind of continuity of the senses. But I do think consciousness was certainly very, very different, and it's very hard to have access to that. Of course, in Homer we have some access to some kind of consciousness from that time, and in the Hebrew Bible also we have written records. That can be a way in, I think. But even though it's really interesting and I think important to find points of connection between peoples in the past and now, I think it's a mistake to think we're all the same and we always were the same. I mean, even now, there are moments when one's confronted with the sheer absolute difference of the way another person thinks and feels. And it's really important to be open to that and continue to be surprised by it and to learn from it.
Mm. Now, so much of your work has involved taking very familiar stories, or, you know, the libretti that you've written are both biblical, it focuses on different aspects of the Bible, and then Bathsheba and David in Luke's, and also Thomas Wyatt, a very well-known figure, the history of the Tudor period, very well-known, and also Achilles, of course. These are figures that many people have presented in art in different ways, and many people have very strong impressions of. How do you, as a writer, deal? I would find that very intimidating, to present such a familiar figure or a world that so many people feel they understand or have, or that means so much to so many people. How do you approach that? How do you deal with that massive bulk of material that's already there?
I don't necessarily find it intimidating. I suppose in an early incarnation I worked as an academic, and among other things I wrote on Shakespeare. And if you're writing on Shakespeare, you can either think, well, it is impossible to contribute anything new to this, or you think Shakespeare is just fantastically nourishing and inspiring and will always generate new thoughts and excitement. And how wonderful to be thinking about this literature. I think with great stories, they are continually new and making themselves new and continually generative. So rather than being intimidated, I felt grateful for the real sort of power that these stories have. Luck, strangely enough, began with Thomas Wyatt, even though the actual book arrives at Thomas Wyatt after two previous sections. The idea for the novel began with Thomas Wyatt, and it was simply love of his poetry and wanting to write something about him, for him. I was very unclear how to do it. I knew I didn't want to write something scholarly about him. I didn't want to get immersed into textual variants in Wyatt's case. And he was a poet, he seems to me one of the first poets whose very breath you can feel on your neck. His irregularity of line is so human and humane and real. He was a poet I fell in love with when I first read him, and for years been looking for a way to honour that.
I think that is something that also comes across really strongly in your work, is this really close engagement, personal engagement with the work of other writers. So in your collection, When I Kissed the Sky, you have three poems thinking of Thomas Hardy. And in the second of those poems, you're focusing on the fact that Hardy's heart was buried in a biscuit tin. And it starts off in the third person, and then you turn it to the second person, almost as though you're turning to Thomas Hardy, as though he's sitting beside you. And how, you know, how strange to think of your heart. I'm paraphrasing, but it feels so personal, and the connection is so strong. Do you feel that to all writers that you read, or is it only certain?
Not to all writers, but to the writers that really matter to me. Yes, they do feel like friends, and they are sustaining. They have, and I think reading work that one really responds to is a very intimate process. I've always disliked the separation that people have between literature and life, as if they were separate. I think if you are a reader and a writer, then literature is a huge part of your life and a huge part of your experience. And I would be so much the poorer. I can't even imagine who I would be if I hadn't been reading all these years. Mm. So yes, Hardy feels like a friend, and Isaac Rosenberg feels like a friend, and certain other writers are just terribly important to me.
I mean, Isaac Rosenberg, you've been a huge champion of. Can you say a little bit about your connection with Isaac Rosenberg? You've introduced me to him, and his work is extraordinary. How did this relationship first start, and where did it lead?
Well, it first started in a bookshop when I was a student, and I just opened up his collected poems and read his poem August 1914, and it felt like a sort of bodily blow. I'd never experienced a poem so strongly before, and so I bought the book and grew to love him. And then subsequently in the 1970s, I found myself living in East London in a tenement flat just round the corner from one of the homes that Rosenberg and his family had lived in. Later on, I got a job as a lecturer at Leeds University and became friends with the poet Geoffrey Hill, who was there then. And along with Geoffrey Hill, we hatched a plot to campaign for a plaque to be put up in commemoration of Rosenberg, because East London isn't really bristling with plaques. And there was a great difficulty there because all the homes that the Rosenberg family rented had been bombed and lost in the Blitz. So even though first the DLC, who we applied to, and subsequently English Heritage, agreed in theory to place a plaque, they didn't know where to put it. Hmm. But then Whitechapel Public Library, which has now been incorporated into the gallery, offered itself to our minds as the ideal place. So it's quite a long campaign with getting a lot of signatories from sort of notable Jewish writers and Gentile writers as well. And it was the ideal place for a plaque to be put up. And so eventually it was. Emmanuel Litvinov unveiled the plaque, and there it sits outside Whitechapel Public Library.
Amazing. And his work is truly wonderful. I was actually astonished that I didn't know of his work when I read it, because it's so powerful and so direct.
Isn't it?
Directness that speaks. There's a certain, among certain poets of a similar vintage, there can be a slight sense of distance. The language has withered slightly with the years, but not with him, I don't think. It's incredibly, or certainly not in the work I've read.
I think he really wrote to save his life, in a way. It didn't save his life, of course, but it was his lifeline completely. And unlike most of the other poets that we think of as the war poets, he wasn't shocked into poetry by the war. His poetry written in the trenches is continuous, I think, with what he wrote before.
Mm. So Isaac wrote to save his life. What's your motivation for writing?
It's interesting. I remember when I was gearing up to leave my academic job, because I felt I needed to do other writing and needed not to be an academic for the rest of my days. I started translating a play by Seneca, his Thyestes, and I had the feeling that if I didn't translate 10 lines a day, I would die. I have no idea where this came from, but maybe there was a similar feeling that I absolutely needed to do it.
A compulsion, almost.
Yes, yes.
Has that been throughout your life, or did this build?
It built, Anne. It built slowly, I think. I wrote occasional poems when I was a student, but not many. Poetry came relatively late.
But was it poetry? I mean, I know you wrote stories as a child, but was it poetry as an adult that was your first?
No, it wasn't. I mean, it was what I loved most. Mm. And I think for a long time I thought I valued poetry more than prose fiction. But on reflection, I don't value it more exactly. I value it differently. But I had written some short fiction before I began writing poems regularly. And now I feel that poetry is more at the heart of my writing than anything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think when we first met, you described yourself as a poet first.
Yes.
Almost, certainly.
Yes.
That was the impression I got.
Yeah.
But actually, I mean, you do everything. You're one of the most versatile writers that I...
not a great deal.
So I'm fascinated by your collaboration with Francis Greer. Mm. He was a fantastic composer.
Yes.
How did that work in terms of piecing together the oratorio that you worked on with him? How does that process work?
It was a very enjoyable process, because Francis is a really interesting and delightful person to work with, and unlike some composers, he always wanted the words to come first, which was really helpful for me. So there was never a case, or there was one emergency case when he said, "Now you should be really professional because I need a very short aria with so many beats to the line." But there was just one occasion when that happened. But on the whole, the libretto came first. I would write a scene, as it were, and then send it to him, and then I'd hear his sort of draft of the music. So it was backward and forward like that. One of the difficulties, I would say the principal difficulty for me of working on a libretto, is that if it comes first, which is lovely because I can develop it as I see fit in terms of the drama of it, once I hand it over, it's not set in stone, but it becomes set in music. And it's very, very hard to claw anything back. So with my tendency to wish to draft and redraft, I can't do that after a while, because obviously the work of composition and instrumentation is enormous. I mean, it's a massive task. I don't know how composers do it, really. So I know that I have to hand over and let it go, even though there may be parts that I slightly wince at.
And seeing your work performed in that way, what was that experience?
Oh, it's completely thrilling. It was the Passion of Jesus of Nazareth. Can't say Nazareth, was performed at King's College, Cambridge, and in Minnesota. And it was just extraordinary to have wonderful musicians and the BBC singers really transforming it. There's something about music which lifts language to another level. It had something of my words in it, but it was no longer mine. It was something transformed, really.
A lot of your work touches on or centres around religious topics. Mm. What role does faith play in your writing?
Gosh, it's hard to say. I mean, I don't think of faith as a separate entity. I suppose if it's part of one's life, it embraces the whole of life. I know that for years, I mean, I quite like solitude, probably like an awful lot of writers like solitude and need it. And I sometimes feel that at times my desire for solitude, which I've often expressed as needing time to write, hasn't actually been about writing. It's been about thinking, praying, being. I don't think of faith as a subject. I mean, obviously, writing a libretto, the Passion or the Nativity, those are subjects. Mm-hmm. And working with the Psalms in Lux, that's a subject. But I feel that faith, for want of a better word, isn't a subject, it's a stance or a way of being, mm-hmm. Not even an idea to me, really. So it's a way of experiencing the world. Mm. So in that sense, I suppose it's completely sort of coterminous with the writing.
So it's threaded through it or kind of colours it rather than being something that you write about.
Yeah, I mean, I would write about it if I had to, but...
But you present it, though, because, I mean, you present prayer in your work. You know, you do really carry that experience through in a way that I think is accessible to people, whether they share those beliefs or not, which is powerful, because I think sometimes religious writing can be off-putting to people who don't share those views. And so it's a real art to express that experience in a way that draws everyone into it.
Oh, thank you very much. I think religion's got an justifiably really bad name at the moment, and there are really ugly caricatures of it going under the name of the real thing. It's a tricky time to even sort of own up to this being an important position, as it were, stance. I can't think of the right word.
So all these huge stories that you've taken on, these huge topics, is there anything that you wouldn't write about?
I don't know. I can't imagine writing a thriller because I'm not very good on plot and I never follow them. even on the telly, I don't really follow what's going on. I'm interested in the sort of relationships on the screen, but not in the story. So I can't imagine ever writing such a thing. But no, I don't think anything is necessarily off limits. And I think for a writer, you know, as for a doctor, nothing human should be alien. Mm. So nothing's beyond. Nothing should be beyond. Much might be beyond my capacity, but that's a different matter.
That was Elizabeth Cook talking to me, Anne Morgan. There's more information about Elizabeth's work on the Royal Literary Fund website. This episode was produced by Anne Morgan. Coming up next time, Adriana Hunter talks translation techniques, Simon Robson describes his writing process, and Anna Wilson confronts writer's block. We hope you'll join us.